The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and a watch or tab, also on them.
Service plan required for watch or tab. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. We're continuing our expectations series today. And joining us today is Melissa Kim, well-known around Baltimore for her post-game show, also in Washington for her work on Channel 9. I have that correct, right, Melissa?
Yeah, that's right. It was a new venture this past last year for Channel 9, but it's been a good one so far. I've been out in D.C. I know the area very, very well now.
All right. Well, very cool. We're going to talk about Arthur Maulet and Tyler Linderbaum today. A couple of Ravens who certainly had an impact on the 2023 season, a fine year by the Ravens. But let's start with Arthur Maulet, unrestricted free agent, a slot corner who's re-signed, signed last year for a guaranteed contract, and they brought him in for guaranteed money. This year, his deal is a little different. It's actually interesting. He's re-signed for $1.75 million in 2024. And then there's a $2.25 million option for the team in 2025. Okay, so effectively, he got $1.75 million in total, including his signing bonus this year. He could still be cut, and the Ravens would have $1 million cap savings if they did so. So unusual kind of deal that it would be that highly backloaded. But I know you ran into Arthur Maulet a number of times over the last season. Talk to us a little bit about him.
That deal, I think, is only going to fuel the fire for him a little bit more. I got to tell you, Arthur Maulet, he's a guy that I don't know that a lot of us really got to know until myself and Kyle Barber from Baltimore Beatdown really sat down with him this past season. And I promise you, after hearing his story, you can't not be a fan of him. Actually, my mom, I actually told her about him last season after I'd interviewed him because I was so moved by his story. And she's like, wait, what number is he? Number 10. Okay, we're going to root for number 10 now. That's how much of an impact his story really has. So, I mean, Arthur Maulet is really one of those guys you got to root for because he's such an underdog. He talked to me a lot about his upbringing. He was raised in New Orleans in the Lower Ninth Ward, which is, if you are familiar with New Orleans, not the greatest neighborhood. Yeah, it's tough out there, you know? And so he was the oldest of five, single mother, who wasn't really in the picture a whole lot. And so he told me from a very early age, from the time he was like seven, he was cooking breakfast for his siblings every day before school, you know, really taking care of his family. Because you look around the locker room, right? And obviously from an NFL player standpoint, some of the guys are a little flashy. You know, I remember last year with OBJ, like he would get like a delivery from Hermes, like, you know, sometimes. And obviously it's a lavish lifestyle, of course, right? But Maulet, you never really saw him kind of engaging with that kind of stuff. And I was like, hey, like why? And he's like, look around this locker room. He's like, I'm in a different situation than all these other guys. I don't really do stuff like that, you know? And he was like, for me, it's about, yes, playing in the NFL, but for me, he's like, I'm just trying to feed my family, because he still, you know, for an extent takes care of his four younger siblings. And I remember there was one week where he was like, oh, my niece is coming to a game. It's her first ever NFL game. So I'm really hoping that this is a really special experience for her. So, I mean, yeah. So you hear that about his upbringing, right? And then didn't really play a whole lot of football growing up. And he he was an undrafted guy. His rookie year was in 2017. He came in New Orleans. He was a special teams guy and really had to earn his bread and butter through special teams, as a lot of rookies do. But, you know, he said that he's really been overlooked his entire career, you know? And so for him, when he came to a place like the Ravens — he was previously with the Steelers, by the way — he said that when his season ended with the Steelers the year before he came to the Ravens, he was like, I remember that feeling of like not making it to the playoffs, or not raising a Lombardi. And he said, I went right to work after that. So he moved to LA right after the season ended in January, you know, didn't take any time off. And he's like, I went to work every single day to make sure that somebody would pick me up. And the Ravens did. And I think that for him, he really felt like he had a lot to prove in that locker room, because he knew that he wasn't a name. He wasn't, you know, one of those guys that was a five-star athlete in high school, coming out of high school. And so I think that really fueled his fight. I think we saw a lot of that last year, because he knew that, especially when playing defense, his spot wasn't given to him. You know, he was having to earn every single rep that he was given. So I it's hard to not root for him.
All right, just to frame this up for people, he's earned a not unrespectable $6.6 million in his career, okay? But that also, when you consider he's earning that all in a very short period of time, the very high, significant amount of taxes paid on that. And he's, like all NFL players, he has to be very concerned about where his money's coming from after he retires. Very important for a player like this to maintain a role as a survivor on the fringe of an NFL roster for as long as he can. And I think he's probably got, from what I'm hearing there, the right attitude. He's a little more than that in terms of how he's paid right now. He's making a little more than just survivor salary. Like, we'll talk about Malik Harrison on the next episode. Mm-hmm. He's really now in survivor mode. He's going to make pretty much the vet minimum for the rest of his career, I would expect, unless there's some sort of odd breakthrough. But Mollett is a guy who has probably a couple of years left in the league and knows he's getting the end of his income stream. There's other players like that. Brent Urban is pretty much mm-hmm. in the same position, for example. And it is nice to see guys really being careful with their money under those circumstances and not living up to the maximum they could with a million or $1.5 million salary that you could do otherwise.
Yeah, for sure. And I think like I was saying, he was like, I mean, I'm not going to be buying like a Ferrari anytime soon or anything like that. You know what I mean? And again, he has a responsibility because he knows he has a tight-knit family. He's got siblings and nieces and nephews and all that to take care of too. So he's definitely, he had to grow up so fast at such a young age. And I think that we're seeing that play out in all of his adult responsibilities, you know?
That really is great to hear. Let's turn it back to the football field for a minute. Mm-hmm. His last year, his path to the starting slot corner job, which he's got a niche slot corner role we'll talk about in a minute, was kind of slow to take up. Ardarius Washington was the guy who really flashed in camp and won the job clear. And Mollett had been hurt during a lot of camp in the preseason. He did hang on the team. Part of it was that guaranteed salary he had really incented the Ravens to keep him around, because they you know, had value that they could still harvest from that. But they had a lot of people in camp last year, as you know, Melissa, who were playing there. They started with Brandon Stevens at slot, and they moved through several different players that didn't work out, including some UDFAs. But Mollett was the guy who, after Washington got hurt in week two, I guess. Mollett came in and got the passing down slot corner role. So obviously this is a year, and we've talked about Kyle Hamilton before. Kyle Hamilton's value in the slot was just tremendous. He was there on early downs. Basically anytime the other team played 12 personnel, the Ravens tried to match up with Hamilton in the slot. But other times, even on early downs, sometimes when they would play 11, Hamilton would still be in the slot. And on obvious passing downs, then they brought in Mollett to try and stop drives and to try and deal with third downs.
Yeah, I think that when you mentioned the injury situation, right, like I think that is something that this team has had to deal with quite a bit, mm-hmm. right, in the last couple of years. We know this for sure. And I think that the value of someone like, or the experience, whatever, someone like Mollett and some of these other guys, like you mentioned, Brandon Stevens too, they were always kind of there waiting in the wings. And that depth, I think, has really helped this team overall. And I think that Mollett is definitely a part of that, especially after, you know, we expected to see a lot more of Ardarius Washington last season, and we did not, you know. So I think that that has been there's so many examples of that, I think, on this team when you think about that kind of situation. Because I remember talking to Brandon Stevens, too, at camp and asking him, like, which one of these positions are you, like, the most comfortable in? And he was like, I will do whatever, you know what I mean? Yeah. So a lot of these guys are really accustomed to, I will just play the best at whatever situation I'm being put into.
Yeah, and that's been a topic that we've touched on briefly before on this show, was that Brandon Stevens, if they took him off cornerback this year, they'd be doing him a tremendous disservice. I don't think he would be cool with it at all. So hopefully he stays at right corner and earns his payday, based on that. Because if he's moved around again, I don't think it'd be cool.
No, definitely not.
So Mollett, unflashy but effective, I would call him as a man defender. He's fairly sticky even for the slot. He's definitely big for the slot at 5'11", so a player who is, got more than your typical slot size, tough downhill player. One thing we did notice, he got picked on a little bit when isolated deep. And the play that will come to mind to everybody is he's the guy who got beat by MVS for the long pass that sealed the AFC Championship game. But there are others during the year where he's beaten for some longer plays. There are also a few plays where the tackling behind him, and some of this I have to attribute to Marcus Williams and his injury, really let him down on some longer plays.
Yeah, I think that that's something that with there's certain players, right, where you can see the emotion on their faces when things like that happen. Mm-hmm. Mollett is definitely one of those guys. You can obviously sense the frustration. Like, you could see it on his face. You could read it in his body language for sure. But those are the kinds of things, I think, for guys like Mollett and for a large number of the guys, especially on this Ravens squad, in talking to them at minicamp and hearing from them at minicamp, they're just like, last year's last year. Like, you know, we're turning the page. This is this upcoming season. It's in the back of their minds for sure as motivation, but I don't necessarily think that they're dwelling on that kind of thing. You know, we heard Marcus Williams actually talk about that at minicamp this past minicamp when, everyone was like, you basically were playing with one arm last season. What's it going to be like playing with two? And he's like, no, I mean, that's not an excuse. No excuses, you know? So I think that the mindset, of course, is going to be important. And I think that they're not really... No, but none of them wants to relive that AFC Championship game last year at all.
Right. Kind of mixed coverage metrics this last year for Mollett. I usually talk yards per target on this show. 8.2 is a little bit high to give up in the slot. 8.1 yak per reception is the really big, bad number. That's a lot of long plays after the catch, obviously. And there were some tackling issues, a little bit from him, but a little bit also from the people behind him. But then when you get back to it, he only allowed one touchdown, had one interception, 85.8 opposing passer rating is pretty good. And overall, I'd say it was a solid but unspectacular year. But it was the kind of thing that having Arthur Mollett is the kind of player you can work with in McDonald's scheme. McDonald's very strong two safeties in terms of coverage, in theory, would really help. And I think he and Darby and Stevens all kind of benefited from having two solid guys over the top.
Yeah, I mean, definitely the one touchdown, one interception, I think that stands out for sure. But also when you mentioned tackling, it's interesting when you mentioned that, because that is something that has become, that was a topic of conversation earlier in the season last year, I want to say, when we were seeing numbers like that, you know, when we were seeing a lot of missed tackles leading to big plays, you know, from the opposing side. And so it's something that was certainly frequently asked about for sure. I say that a little bit in jest, because I think every time that kind of came up, the coaches would kind of be like, I'm sure they were internally groaning, being like, oh, we have to talk about this again. But I mean, it comes down to fundamentals. You know, I think that at the end of the day, like, tackle low, like, try not to get too high. And I think that that is something that everybody on this defense is certainly very, very aware of, because we've literally beat it to death. So hopefully that will not be a top conversation this upcoming season.
And despite the fact that he had kind of a high missed tackle rate personally at 20%, 9 missed tackles, he also had 22 defensive stops. Now, those are wins by the old Football Outsiders definition. So it's basically when the offense, the opposing offense is not keeping up with their down and distance requirement. Those are very big, and they're especially big for a player coming in and playing a lot of third downs, because a lot of those times he's getting a stop by making a tackle short of the line to gain. If you, by definition, if you make the line to gain, you always get an offensive win on any down. So anyway, he definitely had a significant number of offensive wins in this last year. And he is a guy, you know, it's a kind of barbelled results, I guess I would say, is some of his missed tackles went for big plays, but he also had tackles, you know, made for short yardage, for losses in some cases, and for lots of defensive wins.
Yeah. And I think that when you think about those moments, those like key moments where he did make those stops, you know what I mean? I think that that is perhaps what the front office, what they were looking at for the season. Like, hey, this is a guy that has potential, I think, to potentially keep on growing, especially having another year in which, you know, Zach Orr is the new defensive coordinator, but I mean, it's still going to be a lot of the same concepts. I think that that goes without saying. We all know that. And so I think that they have seen the potential in the growth and what he can do. So I think that that is really great for him. Again, a guy that you got to root for here, but yeah.
All right. Decent ball skills. He had the interception. He had 5 total PDs. It's a fairly limited context, his play, since he's playing on third down and only third downs, obvious passing downs. He did get a fair amount of play on the Ravens this last year from the fact that the Ravens had a lot of leads. And when he's in there, then the Ravens go into much more of a pass defense mode. They're not trying to use Hamilton as a weapon close to the line of scrimmage. They're using Hamilton more like the shield back off the line of scrimmage. But in any case, Mullette, I think he pretty much delivered on exactly the season that the Ravens could have hoped for this last year when they signed him. If we look forward to 2024, what we do is we have a good season level and a great season level. So what I'll let you do is, if you want to go first, talk about what a good season might look like to you from Arthur Mullette, and I'll talk about that, and then we'll go to great and great.
For good season, I think that he just continues to build off of what he did last year. You know what I mean? I think that remains to be seen where he's going to fit in terms of personnel. Obviously, we know Ardarius Washington is now healthy. And so I think that from what I know about Arthur Mullette, the way that he is going to perceive having a good season is that being able to make more of those stops. But like, I think that for him, it's going to be like not having like those misses, like you said, from before. And so I think just being able to deliver where he is needed, I think that for him, he would consider that a good season.
All right. All right. I've got a long thing. The 60th percentile for me is not, is a good season. And I'll just read you what I have. I said, makes the team and retains his passing down slot corner role to at least start the season. I don't even think it'd be that terrible if Ardarius Washington takes it back from him, honestly. You know, Ardarius Washington had it one night. He's younger. There's reasons why the Ravens should want Ardarius Washington to have the role. Coverage metrics improved slightly from 2023 with fewer big plays, reducing his yards per target and his yak per reception. So make a few more tackles, you reduce both those metrics, and you're in good shape. Continues to make a 3-unit contribution on special teams. He doesn't play on punt coverage, but he plays on the other 3 mm-hmm. kick and punt teams. So that's a big component to his contributions. I think it's definitely a good season if he remains in the Ravens' set of options for 2025. Now, he signed for 2025, but there's a big incentive for the Ravens to cut him prior to that year. So if he remains in the set of options, it's certainly a good year from my perspective.
Yeah, and I think that if they retain him, I think he would also consider that to probably be, you know, a great season for him. I think that that would definitely be the case. But yeah, I mean, again, a guy that you got to root for, you know what I mean, and knowing his story and everything. So I think that for sure, obviously we want all these guys to go, but Mullette is almost someone that I always kind of like have on my radar all the time.
All right, so a great season. You're saying the Ravens.
He gets to stay for another year. I think that would probably be in his mind. That would be the best option for him.
That would be very good. This is the 80th percentile. I'm saying retains a slot corner role, continues to play approximately 25 to 27 snaps per game because the Ravens have leads to defend late. So that's a big thing. Is it was big for the Ravens if they have leads. Empowered to attempt and make more splash plays. Now, Mallett is a physical player who's good first and second to the ball. But what I'd say is if he has more opportunities to strip as the second man, to take interception gambles on some undercuts because he trusts the safeties behind him, and to make good use of pursuit, a lot of forced fumbles occur because of hustle. Somebody from behind the ball, often a defensive lineman, but can be anybody, comes up and knocks the ball free. I want to see that. And at the end of 2024, if the Ravens are looking at Arthur Mallett and saying, we still got a slot corner for next year at $2.25 million, and not only that, that's valuable because we think he might be worth $4 million. That's a great year.
Yeah. And also, it's funny because I think I asked him at one point last year, like, what would this make this like a great first year with the Ravens for you? And I remember he told me getting to hold of a Lombardi in February. So, you know, that probably would be on his list of a great season as well, I am sure.
Well, that works for all of us. I think we'll agree on that. We'll be fine if the Ravens draft 32nd in the 2026
we're totally fine with that.
Draft.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on and talk a little bit about Tyler Linderbaum. He's entering his third season after a huge step forward in year two. There's a very sharp divergence in his run and pass blocking as a rookie that made people kind of believe more than they probably should have in Tyler Linderbaum during his first year when he was had a very bad pass blocking year, third worst of all the centers in the league. But the way that PFF combined scores made people think it was good. Well, last year he turned it around, had a fantastic pass blocking year, and was third or second from the top in that. And if you look at PFF's combined rankings, I believe he's actually hurt by PFF's off-kilter 85-15 run blocking weighting, run to pass blocking weighting that they have in their combined scores. Because the five guys ahead of him are the five run blockers who scored a little better than him last year, but he was the best pass blocker, and he's all the way down to number six or second, tied for the best with Ryan Kelly. I just thought that was interesting. But why don't you start with a personal story, if you will, about Tyler Linderbaum, because yours are always great.
Oh gosh. Linderbaum is a guy. So like the stark difference between like a guy like Mallett and a guy like Linderbaum, Mallett will talk your ear off. He will talk for a long time. You know what I mean? But Linderbaum is a little bit more reserved, I want to say. He's kind of in the locker room side of, he's like next to like Pat McCary, Mark Andrews, guys who are not as chatty, so to speak, you know? And Linderbaum has always been the kind of guy when I've asked like other guys about him, because unfortunately, on the O-line, the guys that I was super tight with are now gone. Morgan Moses, John Simpson, Kevin Zeitler, those were my dudes. And they are obviously no longer with us, unfortunately. But they would always have really great stories about Linderbaum. I remember Kevin Zeitler in Linderbaum's rookie year. He was like, no, this guy's like, his technique is like on point of any like young guy I've ever seen. And he's like, that's something you have to be born with. He's like, that's inherent. You know what I mean? He's like stunts. He's like, that's not something that you can teach. He's like, his brain is just so like, his football IQ is so high. So that's one of the things that I remember about Tyler Linderbaum and stories about him. And it's so funny because when you ask him about the other guys, he will kind of be very complimentary. He's very humble, I want to say too, you know, like you kind of tell him about all these accolades and like how great he's doing and whatever PFF score of the week. And he'll just be like, whatever. But he's so level-headed. That's the one thing that I've always noticed about him. For a guy who's so young, like you rarely see any kind of emotion on his face. His like poker face is immaculate. And like, I remember asking him about that before. And he was like, look, he's like, you can't get too high, can't get too low. He's like, that's the greatest thing about this game. He's like, it's an imperfect game. Things are going to happen. And you're going to have to stay level-headed because that's the only way. He's like, because you have to stay humble this game, because otherwise the game is going to humble you. You know, and I think that was like pretty poignant in terms of, you know, how his approach is. And also, this like made a lot of sense for me too, because we in the media, I think this kind of applies to us as well. And maybe any other job where you have like one day that's kind of like your big game day, right? Because he was like, if you're preparing correctly, and I remember Patrick Queen used to say this too, if you're preparing correctly, you know, practice Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, it should be really hard. It should be tough. Like you should want to like, you know, be physically challenged and mentally challenged. He's like, on Saturday, you're cleaning up anything possible on film and then the game plan. He's like, and once it's Sunday, you're going out there as prepared as possible, ready to go mentally and physically and emotionally. So it should be easy. Like Sunday is supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be the day where you're kind of not, you're going through the motions because without thinking about it, because you've already done it so much Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So I feel like that kind of is very exemplary of the mindset of Tyler Linderbaum and what he encapsulates in terms of his game and how he prepares and why he's been so successful, especially in year two.
Yeah. Well, that's it's great to hear that. And when you have corroborating personalities that go with the play on the field, it's really good to hear that and think, yeah, that could continue that way. A guy who thinks like that and a guy who has a view of his post-retirement life often, I take very positively in terms of what to expect from a player as he goes through his preparations and what his work ethic is, all of that in terms of how things are going to work. Linderbaum, his quickness is still as advertised in the run game. That was really his calling card coming out of school. He's had a lot of week-to-week variation in his rookie year in particular in terms of how he graded out as a pass blocker in particular. When you have a bad pass blocking year, this is a little behind the curtains. It really shows up in a variation of my week-to-week grading and also on PFF if you look at their pass blocking grading, for example, week-to-week. But it really shows up in the grades. He only had one F in this last season. That was in Week 10 versus Cleveland where he's 3 points short of passing. I call that a high F or a not falling off the table. That's a really good year. Most players will pick up an F at some point. Have one bad game. It's just normal to have that sort of week-to-week variation. But he's been, like you mentioned, a level-headed kid who's thinking about just being prepared as he can every week. It's nice. Seems more like Marshall Yanda than some of the other players who have sine curve kind of results in what they're doing. Let's move on. Snaps were a big issue a couple of years ago. You can really tell when Linderbaum or somebody else is in the football game. Linderbaum is now very good at delivering belly button high or belt high fastballs to Lamar. Whereas when we had Bradley Bozeman there, it was more of a 12-6 curveball, and they were showing up at all different levels on Lamar. It also took the football longer to get there. Which is something you really notice when you're just looking at the side on the regular broadcast view, play after play. You notice snap after snap. There's different variation to this. You don't even have to mess with the width of the snap, but just the height of it is very different.
Yeah, and consistency too. I think with when you notice the change from Bozeman to Linderbaum, this is not a knock on Bozeman, obviously, but you know that like you do see the consistency in that because obviously. There's a thing with I think Tyler was the one that actually said this before. He was like, if you guys are talking about me, he's like, it's usually a bad thing. So, you know what I mean? So I think that he definitely works hard to be consistent too, like when you talk about snaps and all that initially too. So I think that that is something that we especially have seen in year two for sure within their bond.
Now, he did have the one bad snap against the Rams that went way wide. Lamar wasn't ready for it, but it was also way wide. Lamar had to run after it and kick it out of the end zone for a safety. I have no idea how PFF did not score him for a sack allowed on that play, but they didn't. By the way, PFF has a total of something. I think they have zero sacks for him for the whole year. But if I look at this for Tyler Linderbaum, I've got him for 2.5 sacks and it's all partials. It was a total of 6 different partial sacks. He gave up the total of those 3. So one of the things that will come up is that PFF does not, have the first pressure necessarily share in the sack at all if somebody else makes the sack. So the most common kind of Linderbaum sack is he gets pushed back into the cone. Lamar has to move and somebody else takes Lamar down, say off the edge or from anywhere else. Well, in the PFF world, he's not charged. He still gets a 0. He gets a pressure, but he gets a 0 in the sack column. And that's not the way I score it. I divide out that sack among the players who deserve it using fractions if necessary. So anyway, a little bit of a difference. It doesn't take anything away from him. He had a great year. He had a great pass blocking year. And I think one of the interesting things to look at is just how many of Joe D's linemen have really gotten better as they've gone on. Linderbaum, obviously one of the really high pedigree linemen the Ravens have ever had. You know, he's up there with the other first round picks, with Stanley, with Ogden, in terms of the pedigree. But if you look at the other players they've had and how they've improved, there's been a good record of that. And maybe, I don't know if you want to talk about anybody from the list, or you want to talk about anybody at all in terms of players that improved under Joe D.
I mean, I think that's a big credit to Joe D himself, right? Anybody in the media will tell you, like, I'm obsessed with Joe D, and like, I love him so much because he's like 70 years old, and like, he's out there literally doing these workouts with the, you know, doing all the drills, like, with the guys, like, not even a joke. And he definitely still works out, because we always talk, it's a fun, there's like a joke kind of we have like on the sideline sometimes, like, Joe D has like some of the best calves like on the team, because you can tell that that man still works out, like, seriously, at age 70. No, but the amount of respect that they have for this man, you know. And I believe Jeff Zurebeck, I think, did a lovely piece on him last year and everything that he had gone through after his wife passed away, and with his family. He did a story, I think, with his three daughters, and it's just brilliant, brilliant writing. But Joe D is like one of those coaches that you can tell that he's like one of those old school gritty guys. And I think the guys, even the younger guys, seem how they respect that. And like, you know, again, he's always talking about how the generational gap between himself and like Daniel Fa'alele is like decades, right? But still, the way that he conducts himself and his attitude towards these guys, like, you can tell that he A, still loves his job, B, still cares, obviously, and like, C, a lot of those guys really do buy into that and they adhere to that. I think it was John Simpson who told me last year that he's one of the best O-line coaches I've ever had in my career. You know, he's hard on you. Like, don't get me wrong. I have heard Joe D swear at some dudes, like, you know, on the sideline before, because they are not getting things done right. And, you know, but because he's been around for so long, there's just an inherent respect. And I remember John telling me, he's like, the first time that Joe D said he was proud of me, it was like, oh, like, you know what I mean? You get overwhelmed with emotion because, you know, even if you do make a mistake, I can't remember who, I think it was either John or it was Daniel Fa'alele who told me, like, you know, even if I do make a mistake, it's like, you feel bad because you've disappointed like your grandpa, essentially, you know? And so you feel like you have to do like so much better the next time around. And I think that's what, Joe D inherently like brings to this O-line. And I think that we've seen the success of it in the time that he's been here. And I know this year, obviously, again, it's a big change. They've lost three guys at least. And we did ask Coach Harbaugh at the end of minicamp, like, is there anybody in particular that has stood out to you in terms of what these starting roles will look like? And you know, he's not gonna tell us anything right now, but he was kind of like, oh no, like, everyone's just doing great. I do know that a couple of these guys are really working hard, you know, have worked hard in the offseason to get their bodies right, to stay healthy. He might get mad at me for telling this, actually, but Daniel Fa'alele, actually, he's gotten into Pilates. He's doing Pilates, you know, for his mobility and his strength and stuff like that, which, by the way, I think I'm not just saying this because I'm a Pilates stan. Like, I go to a studio in Fells Point literally every day, little free nugget there. But, you know, it really is helpful in terms of like strengthening your Achilles and really helping with mobility, especially for some of these bigger guys that that have a lot of weight to carry, you know, like on their joints. And so, sorry, I'm getting like off topic here and stuff like that, and talking about these guys. But in terms of Joe D and what he brings, I think, yeah, I mean, I think it's like trying to impress your grandpa and make your grandpa happy, you know. And I think that that is how he has really helped out a lot of these guys, aside from like the obvious like X's and O's and, you know, his technique and stuff like that. Go ahead.
It's interesting that you bring this up. I know Simpson in particular is a player that my particular frustration with him was that he came to the Ravens and he'd allowed one penalty been flagged for one.
Oh, I remember that one. Yep.
Every 95 and a half snaps, basically. And with
Ravens, he knows that too.
Incredibly. He's heard it too. He's heard that exact snap. I'm probably the only one who's calculated.
No, I have brought it up to him before. Every time, like, he's had a flag or something like that, the next week in the locker room. So there were a couple of guys I would talk to, like, every week without a doubt, just to, like, kind of catch up on life and whatever. And John Simpson was one of them. He knew I was going to come in and talk to him every week, one-on-one. And so I would always kind of bring up, like, John, so, like, what happened here? Be like, oh, like, I know. He knew it. Like, I mean, he was definitely mad at himself in those instances, too. But, like, yeah, I mean, he knew. Like, you know what I mean? So I think he would share in your frustration, I am sure.
Okay. Well, it's good to be self-effacing with what happened there. But he basically had the exact same rate with the Ravens that he had with the Raiders, which was that was the big bummer in terms of getting him right. I mean, the Ravens got him because I think they saw raw talent there. He's built really like an offensive tackle, even in a lot of ways with his length and size, much more of an upright athlete. But a guy who should be able to reduce his penalties, should be able to improve his technique, should know when to give up to avoid those holding calls. And a lot of them were these really costly post-snap fouls, so it gives the option of the defense to decline the penalty. And it's just the kind of thing that I would think the Ravens could have fixed him, and they really didn't get it done. And now this year, the reason this is more relevant is they brought in Josh Jacobs. Now, here's the tidbit for you to take back to camp and ask him about. Josh Jacobs has a 36% higher penalty rate than John Simpson.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so he gets penalized every, I think it's about 70 snaps in his career instead of every 95. So the Ravens are going to have to figure out how to get this done. And they've taken another chance where the first one didn't work out in terms of really putting this, I think, on Joe D. A lot of it's post-snap. It's not, you know, false start things where he could like maybe learn to be better against a machine or something, but it's post-snap fouls. It's knowing when to give up on holding flags. It's knowing how to, you know, not put your hand in the wrong position so you get up in somebody's face and whatnot. It's, and you know, some of it's illegal formation penalties in the case of Jacobs, but boy, declinable fouls need to be reduced. And a lot of that's on Joe D. And I think it's probably, if I had to point to one thing where Joe D has, that's not something he's proved, is he really hasn't proved he could reduce an alignment who has a penalty problem and make it better. And there have been some who've been a little better over the years, but I haven't really seen a consistent pattern of improvement in penalties. Lots of technique improvement. Anybody can learn to pull from Joe D because he's the master of teaching that. But I really have not seen him do that. And maybe I'm not being fair. Maybe there's some player in the past I'm not remembering. I got kind of the list of linemen that he's coaching right in front of me.
No, I see that. You know how that comes out? Like what I remember, like from 2 years ago, you know, who's really not great with that was Villanueva, right? Like that was one that comes to mind for me when you were like penalties and holdings with that. Cause constantly like you would know that it was him after they blew the whistle, you know, but yeah, on this list, the one interesting one that you have put out here that about the, we don't know, is Ben Cleveland. I think he is the ultimate mystery on this offensive line. Yeah. Like what are we doing? Like, I mean, where are we going? Where's the direction? Because I mean, you look at it purely just from a size standpoint. I mean, he is a ginormous human being.
You know? Didn't you know it's possible to get THC shipped right to your door? Mood delivers premium 100% federally legal THC directly to you. I'm talking about delicious high potency gummies, top shelf flower, home baked cookies, vapes, anything you'd find at a dispensary. You can now order online and have it shipped quickly, discreetly, and conveniently right to your door. And every Mood product is made from pesticide-free cannabis grown on America's best small farms at prices that won't destroy your wallet. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code RAVENS. So head to mood.com/ravens, check out their online dispensary, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code RAVENS when you check out to save 20% on your first order.
Hey, y'all, it's Kelly Clarkson here to talk Wayfair. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Access big savings every day, all in the Kroger app.
Get tender Heritage Farm boneless chicken breast for $2.49 a pound. Then find low prices on thousands of items like sparkling ice water, Kroger brand chips, and more, all with your card.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Know like it, and he's been here, he has made the cut every year, and we're kind of like, when are we going to see you emerge?
It's a great point. And you know, last year, okay, I don't want, we're going to go into the weeds a little bit on this. John Simpson was already in from Las Vegas. I hypothesized that he might have been the subject of some mind game playing by the Ravens coaching staff to put Saleh in at left guard during OTAs and mini camps. And so Saleh was getting all the first team reps and was getting there. And to me, Simpson was so far ahead of Saleh. And by the preseason, we saw just Saleh's not ready to play NFL football. I mean, he wasn't last year. He goes into this year still as a developmental, you know, option for the Ravens. But we Simpson was so far ahead of him, it wasn't even funny in terms of getting anything. But my hypothesis was that they did that to motivate John Simpson, is that they basically thought, here's a guy who came with a lot of excuses from Oakland potentially, or could have had them, even if he didn't. And you know, they wanted him to really be motivated to win the job, as opposed to just having it given to him and then having those excuses over the penalties and whatnot. But this year, I think they could be doing the same thing with Ben Cleveland. You know, I've heard some of the reports about he's not playing as much with the first team as one might expect during OTAs at minicamp. And if that's the case, then I would not be surprised if that they're trying to motivate him too as well. Obviously, he had the big wedding overweight. could you notice him carrying additional weight like that, or is he just so large?
I mean, he's just so hard. It's kind of hard to tell, you know, because you think about like some of the bigger guys on that O-line. For me, it's Cleveland and Fa'alele, right? And Fa'alele, to his credit, I'm not just saying this because he does Pilates, but like you can tell that the noticeable weight difference. I think he definitely lost a lot of weight from like when he first came in, because I remember at the first training camp or the first couple of days, like you could tell that he was gassed, like, you know, early on, and like maybe it was like I don't know what he wasn't used to yet. So you definitely notice a difference in that. Cleveland, I mean, I guess maybe because he is a little, I think he is a little bit in terms of like height, like taller than Fa'ale. Like, I mean, he's just so big. Like, I mean, I don't think you really notice a huge difference. I mean, yeah, I mean, hopefully that will fuel his fire a little bit more this season for Cleveland. But like, yeah, I mean, he's a guy that we're just kind of like, where are we going? What are we doing? You know, I'm hoping that, he will deliver, we'll say. Yeah. At least like see where, at least give us an idea where he's going. You know what I mean? This training camp.
It really makes sense to me that it'll be Voorhees at left guard and Cleveland at right guard. They've kind of held him back out of the left guard spot for a lot of time. He did play a little bit there as a rookie and a little bit there as well in his second and third years. But he basically, they held him off to play right guard for Zeitler in year three. And it looks like he's probably Zeitler's replacement. He's got the length and he's got the strength, certainly to open the front door. And so does Voorhees. Voorhees is not only a big human being. He's got decent length, but he's extraordinarily strong. And so he's the kind of guy you want torquing that, defensive tackle as you're trying to open a hole in a level two. And it's going to be fun to watch how this line blocks for Derrick Henry this year and open some holes so that Henry gets a lot of good first contact opportunities in level two. So it's not a lineman who's dragging him down. It's not somebody in the backfield is there, but it's you know, a linebacker really having to try and meet and head on and make a more difficult tackle.
Yeah, I think it's been really fun to watch, to be honest with you, now that we're talking about Derrick Henry for sure, who, like, by the way, I covered in college at Alabama. And I had not seen him since then until I got to minicamp. And I was like, oh, you have definitely, I mean, he is obviously, this is like 5-8 years ago. Like, he's a stark difference in the physical size and the strength of Derrick Henry from college till now, expectedly so. But back to the O-line. Yeah, this was like the one position, the one group that I was really trying to keep in a hard, close eye on during minicamp because of all the changes that are obviously inherently here for this O-line. So I think it's going to be a little bit of experimenting probably in the beginning for sure. But I think it's going to, once they figure it out and like get it together, I think that it's going to be a good group, because you think about the previous year to last year, the only change there was John Simpson, you know? And so I think that like kind of helped them obviously gel and mesh and all that stuff together. But I think that that's going to be probably one of the biggest challenges, is how are these guys going to play together?
Right. Totally. A lot of it's on Linderbaum, who we'll circle back to here, because he's going to be the one constant we can really count on. Ronnie Stanley, I'm very hopeful that he'll have a big year, but you know, we've been through Ronnie's career and he's missed games pretty much every year. So yeah. If there's you know, if he misses some time, we'd have to consider it not completely unexpected. Whereas it's really hope that Linderbaum can be the glue who holds this unit together. Last year, I would say it was still Kevin Zeitler. Was the guy, and Linderbaum, but Kevin Zeitler, who was you know, in a lot of ways the glue and is part of the signal calling effort on that line, obviously, in terms of what they're doing. It's all on Linderbaum this year. It's all on Linderbaum. I hope he's ready.
And I think he is. Like, now that he's like gotten that, obviously now going into year three. And yeah, because I know that those two were pretty close to Zeitler. And the Linderbaum, because I mean, obviously Kevin Zeitler, I think, comes with an inherent respect. He himself has called himself insane because he knows that he's that much of a workhorse. And I remember it was before Zeitler's, I think it was his like 100th win, career win. And the O-line so badly wanted to get the win for him. Right. And on top of that, I remember Tyler in particular, I've written in my notes that he had learned so much from Kevin in terms of his focus, and like, he's always, always working on his craft. No days off for Kevin Zeitler, and he will admittedly tell you that. And because everyone talks about the video of like when his wife is having his second daughter and the process in the hospital room. And so I think that the guys, like, once they saw that, they're like, oh, this guy is like definitely different. And they've all taken a little bit from that. Even guys like Morgan Moses, who've been in the league for like a decade, he would always say like Zeit is like a different kind of person. And I believe that for sure, because not to get off on totally on a side, but it does have to do with Linderbaum a little bit, because they're both kind of from those Iowa, Wisconsin, those kind of schools that really do churn out some of the best offensive linemen in the league. I think about Joe Thomas, you know what I mean? I think about some of those guys. And even though they obviously did not play anywhere close to the same time, like, you know, the tradition and I think the expectation of the guys that come out of schools like that is still there. So I think that they definitely identified the Midwest connection was definitely a big thing between them as well, because they came from kind of the same school, the same mindset of how to play this position and what is expected of you.
All right. I would agree with that. Kirk Ferentz has a terrific reputation for passing through linemen of the NFL that certainly has worked out for him. So I don't want to get too much into, you know, where I think Linderbaum is among the league centers. I said a little bit about it before, but there are a handful of centers that are at the very top of the game right now. And the five guys that are ahead of them are on the PFF ladder are guys that are ahead of them because of higher run blocking scores. I mentioned that, but that's Ragnow, Dahlman, McCoy, Kelsey. The only center I really think is his equal or better right now in the AFC for certainly, but maybe in the whole game, is Creed Humphrey. And Humphrey had a little bit of a down year as a pass blocker this last year, but he is one hell of a two-way center. And he's probably the guy who keeps Linderbaum from being AP1 for the foreseeable future. I'll just say, I think Creed Humphrey has got the respect, but I think we're going to start this year. I think might be the first year we see Tyler Linderbaum getting some Pro Bowl consideration. And it will depend on who else is having a big year. Obviously it will depend on him being healthy, but it should be a year where he starts to get more respect around the rest of the league and around the voters in particular.
And I think year three is always a big year for a lot of these guys, developmentally speaking. You look at kind of the past guys on this team in particular, I think in year three, and how much they have improved in that particular third year, because, you know, year one is always kind of, especially when you're a guy like in that draft class, like a Kyle Hamilton or like a Tyler Linderbaum, who plays essentially right away a lot. Right. And so I think that first year is a lot of a learning curve, obviously getting used to the pro game as opposed to the college game. Year two, I think there's still a lot of learning happening, right? But you do see the improvements. We've seen stark improvements from both the first round draft picks in that class. And I think year three is really where I think they start to solidify. I think, I'm trying to think of, I think Patrick Queen was one of those guys. I mean, we saw a lot from him in year three, where towards the end of it, he started to make that developmental push and really start to make a name for themselves, like essentially speaking, not that they're already not names, but I do think that year three is going to be, it's going to be a good year, I think, for both those guys. But yeah, I think Linderbaum is definitely part of that conversation.
When we do this expectation series, and I have the comment I made from last year about Linderbaum. So it's my reason for optimism for Tyler Linderbaum last year, because I was very down on his very bad pass blocking season as a rookie. But I said size and length make it unlikely he'll ever be a top pass blocker in the NFL, but there's lots of room for improvement, and he's starting from a much better spot than, say, Garrett Bradbury, who is commonly comped to him in terms of these of size limitations. Last year, my good goal was an improvement to the 40th percentile as a pass blocker, and he far exceeded that, obviously. So he's probably in the 95th percentile now of centers. So that was one of the guys who had way more than a great season. And the fact that I don't hear that talked about regularly is his improvement being as dramatic and as significant to the Ravens in terms of play. The only player who's in the same class as Brandon Stevens in terms of what his play meant over what we could have expected prior to the season. That the cornerback room was in shambles, and Brandon Stevens ended up being the guy who plays, what, 95% of the snaps, 93% of the snaps, and is there every basic snap at right cornerback and solidifying the back end. But Tyler Linderbaum had a similar transformative year in terms of his play at center, and very exciting to see it.
Yeah, I think that it's funny when you were just mentioning Brandon Stevens. I was like, I remember last year when I was doing one of these like preview kind of season things, I remember always saying to everybody, like, my big thing is outside corner. How are we going to work with outside corner? This is like my biggest concern. And they obviously ended up proving us all wrong, which is great. You know what I mean, in the same instance too, like, this is what you want, right? When you're like, oh, like, not sure about this guy. You want to be wrong in the end because you want them to play well, obviously, for this team. But yeah, in terms of Linderbaum, I think, yeah, I mean, that year one, like I said, is just always such a big learning curve for these guys. And I think that that's kind of where you make your mistakes in a lot of these instances. And we see that, I think, not just on this team, but across the league from some of these guys that are thrown into those first rookie year situations. It's almost, you kind of have to expect it at this point. I feel like there's so few guys who come into the league who are just flawlessly transitioning to the level of how they should play, how we expect them to play.
Completely agree with that. Very unusual. Creed Humphrey was a really big counterexample to it, but there's very few linemen who come into the league and they play well as a rookie. It's become more and more rare. I'm looking ahead to 2024, and there are a few things I want to see. But one of the real benefits, he will be potentially tremendously complimented this year by having Voorhees to one side and Cleveland to the other. There's a real value in having mixes of body type, and Linderbaum is a smaller guy and a quicker guy, and you have two very powerful towers next to him. That's a lot of potentially outstanding combination blocks. Whether Linderbaum has the back end or the front, and he's more valuable when he can move to level two, but even when he has to hold a block in level one, having a big man next to you means that defensive tackle is more off balance than he otherwise would be, because if you're Cleveland or if you're Voorhees, you're going to really hammer that guy and help him out. I think we even saw some of that from John Simpson this last year, and certainly from Zeitler, who knows what he's doing in terms of getting a player off his pins for the trailing blocker. But anyway, I think that potentially could benefit him tremendously, having two big men next to him.
I laugh like as you say that, just because like you think, I mean, yeah, there's definitely certainly a big stark difference in terms of pure size just alone between, you know, any of those three guys that you just mentioned. And I definitely agree with you on that, because that's what you want, like, on your O-line, right? Like, bigger guys anyways, to complement him. So yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. I think, again, it's gonna be really, really fun to see what this O-line is gonna be capable of, for sure.
And the other guys they have as options at guard would be still very big men. Josh Jacobs is, you know, 6'5", 320 roughly. Mm-hmm. And so he's a big guy, and he's also a long guy, which is helpful there. But also they have Daniel Faalele may end up playing some guard this year. I think, you know, they're at a point where they kind of got to decide what they're doing with him, because the Ravens have too many tackles right now. So Faalele is actually at risk of being cut. I'm sure he would be taken by another team as a project, but it is a risk. And then the other player whose career is definitely in jeopardy is Saleh right now. who, again, I'm sure somebody else would probably want to take a chance on. But he's a big guy as well. And if he were to play guard next to Linderbaum, whoever he's got there, it's going to be a very large man. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, for sure. And like when you mentioned Fa'alele too, it's interesting to see. It's interesting what they've done with him so far, right? Because they've kind of moved him around to both sides. And then also, you know, he's been at some tackle. Obviously, he's been at some guard. Like, it's almost like an experimental process with him a little bit too in the last 2 years, especially last year. I think they moved him around so much because sometimes he'd be in for Morgan Moses and sometimes he'd be on the other side. You know, they definitely did a lot of experimentation with him, especially because we go back to size. With him, he is like a muscly guy though, you know what I mean? So there's a lot of like strength there, I think, for him. I think I'm just very interested to see as well, like what they do with him, because I'm not sure that they really know yet for sure.
It's one of the big questions, and it's kind of unfortunate for him that he enters year three as a developmental player. Still, that's not where you want your career to be. You want to have some path in mind. You know, you'd hope that John Harbaugh would have had a meeting with him at the end of last year that basically laid out positional goals for him in a way of, here's what we want you working on this offseason. If you're going to go to a camp, try and get this done. We want to see you strike better. We want to see you, you know, if you're going to stay a tackle, we need you to be someone who's more aggressive and punches first. Or if you're going to go to guard, you got to learn how to torque that guy from right guard because we don't think you're going to be on the left side. Whatever they might have told him. You know, I hope they gave him kind of a clear path to run on during the offseason so he could take that to heart and do his own personal development journey, you know, on his own personal coaching there. Do you get the sense that Fa'alele is a guy who is intensely into an off-season program, or do you think he's a guy that it's a relief to have the season over and he's talking about needing time to decompress, needing time to get his body right, more than he's talking about, yep, in 3 weeks I'm going to be there, and then in 5 weeks I'm going to be here at this camp kind of thing?
He's a little bit more of like an easygoing. I'd probably go with the latter, you know, because I think he's a little bit more, from my interactions with him, just a little bit of an easygoing guy, a little bit more chill. I'm sure he took some time off. I mean, I think a lot of the guys did this past offseason. But he's such an interesting person in the sense that, I mean, obviously he's a big stature kind of guy, right? Like, I mean, he's physically imposing right off the bat, but he's also so soft-spoken and so just like thoughtful, you know what I mean? And like almost like, I would say like gentle giant is like kind of the way that I view Fa'alele, because when you ask him like, you know, personal questions and all that, he definitely thinks about it before he tells you his feelings and his thoughts and all that. He's not just someone that's gonna like rattle off like answers and stuff like that. So I know that he's definitely like a big family guy too. He used to be from like Samoa, but his mom I know recently moved to Minnesota too, where he went to school. And his brother, he had a younger brother at IMG Academy down in Florida, who I believe he told me was starting college either this year or next year. But he's going to Dartmouth, so obviously brilliant. Wow. Okay. Definitely an interesting guy. And, you know, I obviously, when you hear me talk about these guys, I'm like, you rarely going to say anything bad about any of them, because I feel like I do have a little bit more of a personal relationship with a lot of them that I talk to week in and week out. And I think a lot of people in the media do feel like that for sure, because you really get to know them as people. But I mean, and in that sense, it's, you know, tough to root against them. But Fa'alele, like, I mean, the fact that he's such a thoughtful soul in that sense, and, you know, I hope that the connect happens between what's happening, like, you know, his physical size and also just his like football brain. I hope that it does really like all mesh together here. So that we do see him a lot more of him in the future. Because he's obviously very talented. You know what I mean? I think that goes without a doubt. But yeah.
I love it when you talk about the moms, because your story about Kyle Hamilton last year, and you both have Korean mothers. You and Kyle do, and that's something you shared in common, and you told us some of the expectations about that. But I'm trying to think if the rules are the same, but you tell me if Daniel Fa'alele's mom is probably more proud of the Dartmouth kid.
Absolutely. I'm sure. It's so funny, like the siblings, right? Because I can't remember. Was Fa'alele's brother playing football? Either was football or basketball. There are definitely a lot of, you know, athletic talent does like run deep for a lot of these kids and their siblings. And not to completely go off topic again, but Odafe Owe's younger brother plays basketball. He was playing at Oklahoma this past season. I think he transferred to Kentucky, I want to say. Oh, wow. But like, it was so funny because Odafe would always talk to me about his brother, and he's like, God, I really hope he makes it into the league this year, and or he gets drafted. And I was like, really? I was like, why? And oh yeah, he's going to Kentucky. Yeah, that's what I thought. He's going to Kentucky. And I was like, okay, why? And he's like, so that they can take some of the pressure off of me. I mean, you know, NBA, like, brother, he's like, I can live off of his salary. You know what I mean? He's like, gosh, like, let's go after him. Like, let's not put all the pressure on me. So, yeah, it's definitely fun to get to know the families and the moms. And, you know, I got to know Geno Stone's mom pretty well last year as well. I interviewed her for a story just kind of after Geno was having so much success. And they're another family too. Again, not to get completely off topic, especially since Gino is also no longer with us. But, you know, that's another family too, where Gino was basically raised by his single mom at a very young age. She had him in her teens. And literally, she told me that her mom was the one that really helped her raise Gino and really bring him up. And she said that he did not want to go far away for college because he's from Pennsylvania, not too far away from here. And he had faced a lot of adversity in his recruiting trip because he had like one visit to Michigan, I want to say, and a couple days before his recruiting trip, like they canceled it because they had signed somebody else. And he was like, oh shoot, what do I do? And he had a trip to Iowa. And so he was like, oh, not sure if I want to go to Iowa. Like, you know, it's so far away. And then his mom was like, no, just go, just try it out, see what happens. He went there. He told me he fell in love with everybody there, obviously, Coach Behrens and everything. And then his mom, because she doesn't like to fly, she drove from Pennsylvania to every single one of his college games, no matter whether it was in Wisconsin or whatever Big Ten school was at. She drove to every single one of them. And he always credits his mom for every success that he has. He's like, it's because I was raised by a really strong mom. Like, you know, and so she really has guided me through everything. And, you know, it's really lovely to get to like put names to faces. And like when people tell you stories, obviously about people, to get to meet them in real life. And after meeting her and talking to her for 5 seconds, I was like, oh, I know exactly why Gino is the way that he is, you know, because she's such a tough cookie. And he's one of those other guys that has always been so, not that anybody's just been disrespectful, but he's so respectful of like women, like, you know what I mean? And you can tell that right away, because I was like, his mom, Aaron Stone, definitely a force. And she's actually really good friends with Kyle Hamilton's mom too. And they would, you know, always, I would sometimes meet up with them before games, before they would go in and stuff. So definitely a good bunch. But yeah, sorry, I went on a completely different tangent.
That's all right. We're talking about people. Tyler Linderbaum somewhere.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
Now I took you down that road. And by the way, we love having you on this show, and it's for those kind of stories that you know, people relate to you so well. But let's talk about Tyler Linderbaum now.
Yes.
What would be a good season for him?
I think consistency, right? I think everybody across the board, but especially for offensive linemen, I've noticed that that is the one thing that they always talk about is consistency. Because at the end of the day, like I said earlier with Linderbaum, he was like, if you guys are talking about us, it's a bad thing. You know, I think that being as close to whatever percentile he was at last year, I think would be a good season for him.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. I put down very simply, run blocking continues to be excellent despite fewer run snaps. I think the Ravens may be passing more this year for multiple reasons. They may be behind in games. They certainly have Derrick Henry. I don't think that necessarily means they're going to have an increase in total run snaps. I think the game situation will drive that more for people who want to burn me right away for that comment. Does not allow new guards to drag down his play. Okay, so Simpson's not really a new guard. Sorry, not Simpson. Cleveland is not really a new guard, but he's getting his first extended play opportunity if that's what ends up happening. Voorhees, it'll be his first NFL experience. Both players are extremely gifted, but it's going to be Linderbaum's job to hold that pass blocking unit together. His pass blocking, I expect to come down a little bit, to regress slightly, just because it went to such a high level. But I think if he could stay near the top of the league, they say the 75th percentile. And boy, I just wanted him at the 40th percentile last year.
But yeah.
So this is good. Maybe he can hurdle this one as well. If he could stay at the 75th percentile as a pass blocker, I think that'd be terrific. It'll be a year of consolidating some of these big gains that he had from last year. But I would expect some minimal regression because of the new guards. I think other players next to you can let you down. And I don't think it's likely they're going to do a lot better than Zeitler and Simpson did for him, in terms of helping him become the pass blocker he was last year. But that's a good season to me.
Yeah, and I think it's tough, you know what I mean? Especially when you have, like, because when you think about it, obviously, like, the position groups all play as units, but especially at O-line, like, that's one of them, that's, I want to say, if not one of the, but or if not the most important one, really, for the offense, because they really do, they run the, I don't know how else to better to put it, like, they run the offense, you know what I mean? Like, if they don't play well together, if there's miscommunication there, I mean, it's not going to be a good play. Like, you know what I mean, like, I think that that goes without saying. I think he, like you said, he is going to have to be the leader in year three and really make sure that everybody communicates. I think that is one of the biggest things that when the O-line did not have their best moments in the last two seasons, when they had some, like, at least some consistency in terms of personnel, I think that is one of those are the moments where we were like, oh, okay. Like, they have got to communicate. So, but before we go to great season, communicate. That, I think that is what I'm going to have to go with for that, especially for Linderbaum, is make sure that you really are the quarterback, like, of this offensive line. I think that he'll be one of those guys that does it quietly, though. Like, you know what I mean? We're not going to see him, like, yelling out and kind of, he's not going to be like a Roquan Smith or like anything like that. You know what I mean? In terms of being vocal. But I think that he is going to have to be the glue for this O-line.
Yeah, I've got something very similar. I will say this. I want him to be vocal, but he doesn't have to be on-field emotive. So he doesn't have to be the kind of guy who hits somebody else in the helmet or on the side.
Oh, he's definitely not going to be. I cannot see that from him at all.
But what he can be is talk in a very low-key way with the guard next to him about what went wrong on that previous play. And then get it right. And there doesn't have to be a backslap. There doesn't have to be a low five. Low five would be the lowest key way. That's the LJ Fort way to do it that I've noticed. I watch a lot of emoting after plays. It tells you a lot about what's going on.
Oh, yeah. It tells you a lot about the person, too. Yeah, for sure.
But anyway, here's what I wrote for him. I said, continues to be discussed as one of the best run blockers in the league. I think he'll be fine there. Both guards fit in well, and the Ravens offensive line provides outstanding cone protection. So basically, you know, keeping people out of Jackson's fear of his legs being landed on when he steps into his throw. That's what I mean by cone protection. Top quartile of the league as a group in that is a great season for Linderbaum. Refines technique further to fully consolidate gains as a pass blocker without regression. So instead of the 75th percentile, I'm saying he's still near the top of the entire league in terms of pass blocking here. And discussion for his first Pro Bowl with overall success of the Ravens offensive line. So if the Ravens have the kind of year they could have and Derrick Henry goes wild, there's going to be a lot of focus on this offensive line. And I think there's very real possibility that Linderbaum will go to the Pro Bowl from it.
I want to go back to something you said, you touched on a little bit before. I meant to, by the way, when you were saying that the expectation is still, despite having Derrick Henry, you know, when you talk about run blocking and Tyler and all that, I don't think that you're wrong in that, in terms of that they're still going to throw the ball a lot despite having Derrick Henry, because you look at Lamar and how he's been developing this offseason, and you look at what he's done in these last couple of off seasons, right? I think every year he's coming in trying to prove that he can be that true dual threat quarterback. And I think I don't think that is going to be something that they stray away from, especially this year too, because Lamar wants to throw more, you know, and he said that for sure. But they're going to let him have a little bit more control of the playbook this year. You know, that's been openly said. And so I think that will definitely play a big part into it too. So I don't think that you're wrong in terms of thinking that, that they're still going to throw the ball a lot despite having Derrick Henry in the backfield. So
yeah, Lamar has a remarkable record of getting the Ravens first half leads. One of the reasons he doesn't have a lot of fourth quarter comebacks is the Ravens are almost never trailing, entering the fourth quarter.
So that's been
pretty sweet, but it has held down his statistics in a way that nobody should be frustrated about. And yet an enormous portion of the fan base seems to be upset that Lamar Jackson does not have a 4,000 yard year. Who cares? He's got two MVPs. He's fully deserved both of them in terms of his aggregate contributions. And the Ravens offense in both those years was top of the league. So it's nothing to complain about that Lamar Jackson has not gotten 4,000 yards. There's no reason for him to do it. It won't mean one additional dollar for him anytime soon. I mean, he's got his contract. It's not like there's something on the line that he's missing out on by not throwing for 4,000 yards. Everybody realizes how great this guy is. I mean, there's just if If it's meant to be, because the Ravens are behind in games, which unfortunately I think is the more likely thing, is they have some struggles defensively and they get behind in some games, or they're not as good on the offensive line and they have trouble scoring in the first half, I think then there's a chance that the Ravens end up throwing more. And I actually don't think that's a good thing at all. when it does, I do unfortunately think it's kind of a likely thing.
Yeah, and look, again, with like the fan move, all that stuff, like they're great. You know what I mean? Like, I think that sometimes, like, no offense to the fan base, like, there's obviously a standard that has been set in this town for what the Ravens should be. And I think that's really good to have high standards, obviously. But also, like, not that I'm saying, like, look down, like, you know, to look down at, like, who was below, you know, the Ravens, stuff like that. But, like, this is a great team. This was a great team last year. Like, did it end in a way that not a lot of us expect? I mean, I thought we were going to the Super Bowl. Like, I'm not even going to lie to you. Like, I mean, I thought that was kind of be an automatic. I had made mental plans like already for that. So I think that, yes, it was a great season last year. I think the potential was certainly there, because I'm not sure we're ever going to see a defense play that kind of defense as we saw last year. You know what I mean? And in terms of the offensive weapons, I wish that the health had been a little bit better for guys like OBJ and, you know, Rashad Bateman and all that. But I think that there's still like quite a bit of potential, which is a dangerous word, I know, that to harp on, to really buy in on potential. I think that there is still a good level of potential that we're going to see this season. And like, obviously the expectation is, I think I don't need to talk about what the expectation is for this team from the fan base or from the guys themselves, especially after the way last season ended.
Well, we're all hoping for big things, certainly. And your point is very well taken about, you can't lose sight of what a great year this last year. And we're talking about it as the AFC Championship game was coming up. And before that, it was one of the greatest football teams ever to take the field. They've got a triple crown defense. They've got a great offense. Mm-hmm. Getting those two at the same time is very rare. They had a special teams unit, which had an off year and was still in the middle of the pack. And that's a unit that's often been one that never let the Ravens down. They weren't even the big reason this last year. But they had a combined offense and defense that was one of the greatest of the, you know, the Football Outsiders DeVoa era. And, you know, we need to appreciate it for what it was. Sure, missed opportunity. It really sucked to lose that game to Kansas City. But it was a great football team, and it's just a darn shame.
It is. If I can say just like one last thing about last year's team before we completely turn the page next season. Yeah. But, I mean, this was such a great group of guys. Just from a human perspective, you could tell that there was something different in that locker room last year than there had been in previous years. I think that the way that they all genuinely got along, and I know this is like everyone says about like, oh, the best Super Bowl winning team, they're like blah, blah blah, like whatever, you know what I mean? But you could definitely tell that this group genuinely really at the very bare minimum respected each other. I mean, we had like Zeitler's wife bringing in cookies every Friday, like, you know what I mean? It was really just like they were genuinely having so much fun with what they were doing and how much they really cared about each other. Because I think the way that Morgan Moses put it this way to me, he's like, look, he's like, we're coming to work, we're coming in every day. We all know that we have families. We all know we have kids. We all should be hanging out with our children or doing whatever on a Saturday, but we're here. And so like to make that time pay off for the respect of the guy next to you, like we're all going to like go to war and like make sure that we put in our 110% effort, you know. And you could definitely tell that they all genuinely really liked each other last year. It was such a fun, great team to be around last year. They were constantly having fun, like the Connect Four games and the cornhole and the whatever else they were playing last year all the time too. You could genuinely tell that they were having a great time being there.
All right. Well, Melissa, thanks so much for coming on. Tell folks where they can either read or watch what you're producing, or also or listen, and yeah, also connect with you online.
Sure. I'm at Melissa Y. Kim on all social media platforms, Twitter/Instagram. And I will be on the fan again this season, I believe. Still some things being worked out, but Friday nights, 2 hours at a time on the Flockdown, and doing post game after the games on game day. So call in. I love when people call in, because I always like to get a pulse on the fan base, because I don't always necessarily get that on social media. So I feel like sometimes like calling on radio is some of the best times that I actually get to interact with people and talk to people. So I love when people call in.
All right. Outstanding, Melissa. Other folks out there, if you'd like to be on a film study short, hit me up. There's lots of time now before camp begins. Actually, there's about 3 weeks now. I'd love to hear from you, and I'll get you on and schedule if you have an idea for a short. If you want to do a recollections, talk about an old player, you can still do that. And I'm going to also have a concerns series. So if you have a concern about the Ravens entering camp, I want to hear from you, and we'll put you on. It can't be all enveloping. You can't talk about need to completely restructure the passing game. If you talk about the Ravens don't have depth at slot receiver, that's maybe a better category. This should be, 15 to 30 minute show, but not a 2 hour show that we're producing here. So anyway, I know a lot of people have a very broad vision to do a show. Melissa, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and a watch or tab. Also, on them.
Service plan required for watch or tab. Trade in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Access big savings every day, all in the Kroger app.
Get tender Heritage Farm boneless chicken breast for $2.49 a pound. Then find low prices on thousands of items like sparkling ice water, Kroger brand chips, and more, all with your card.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.